Jo Emmonsberger is a Canada-based writer whose work is primarily focused on media distortion and confabulation. It appears at fair.org, Venezuela Analysis, The Canary, and counterpunch.org, among other places. Welcome back to the program, Jo.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, Jo, our Prime Minister, Canada's Prime Minister, Pierre Trudeau's son, Justin Trudeau, had a meetup with Juan Guaido, or Juan Guano, as I prefer. He is the man who is in certain media quarters listed as the president, the rightful president of Venezuela. What was the meetup about here in Canada, Jo?
Well, you know, Canada for a long time has been just, this just basically reaffirms Canada's 100% support for Trump's foreign policy towards Venezuela and towards Latin America in general. Basically, when the United States demonizes a country and seeks to overthrow it, Canada plays along. You know, they might critique a bit, but they generally go along. It's been a long-standing approach to foreign policy from Canada, going all the way back to even the Pierre Elliott Trudeau's day, when he was being lauded for doing some things which on the surface looked rebellious. Behind the scenes, they were always very collaborative with the U.S. foreign policy.
Well, and
you know, it's become much more open now. I mean, in the case of Venezuela, the propaganda campaign has been so overwhelming that, you know, Trudeau just basically goes 100% openly along with all the monstrous things that Trump's doing, literally starving the attempting to starve the country into rebellion since August of 2017.
Well, and Canada can boast as well that more than just being a follower, we're leading in some respects as per Venezuela as being the shining light of the Lima Group. For those, Jo, who don't understand what the Lima Group is and what Canada's role in it is, can you explain a little?
Sure. Well, it was established basically by the U.S. and its allies couldn't get the votes they needed in the OAS to, through that organization, to formally expel or sanction Venezuela. So, you know, despite Venezuela's economic collapse since 2014, Venezuelan diplomacy has been able to basically retain enough support, even the OAS, and even with the shift in the region, at least enough to prevent the getting the votes, like the two-thirds or whatever votes they need to expel them or sanction them. So U.S. allies in the region, the right-wing governments plus Canada, set up this informal group called the Lima Group. And recently Haiti was just admitted to it because its president is ruling by decree. So appropriately enough, and of course Bolivia, which is a U.S.-backed dictatorship at the moment, under a U.S.-backed dictatorship, is part of the Lima Group as well. And all these countries, it's really preposterous. I mean, they're supposedly leading the charge to democratize Venezuela when, you know, they're Venezuela, considering that it's under foreign attack, Venezuela is far less authoritarian even in the U.S. Than the U.S. because, you know, the amount of, if you just look at its media, if you look at the ability of its politicians to openly agitate against the government and link up with foreign powers to impose sanctions and threaten it militarily, I mean, they're engaging in a kind of insurrectionist activity, which just a fraction of that in the United States, not even a fraction of that would land them behind bars or worse. So it's really quite astounding, you know. And so it's basically just an informal group. And really, its impact is mainly, it's with the propaganda campaign. It's just to show that, you know, it's to convey to people, like everybody's in agreement on this. And, you know, it may be Trump, you know, because Trump turns a huge number of people off. But with countries like Canada and all these other countries going along, it's mainly a propaganda function, because the United States has the economic and military clout to do a tremendous amount of damage without anybody's assistance. But the propaganda aspect is huge. You know, they need to have cover.
Well, and of course, the political the freedom of political parties to organize and rabble rouse in Venezuela is just one aspect of it. There's also their media has a pretty free hand down there, and the media is certainly not government controlled or even favorable towards the government.
No, of course. In fact, recently, you know, when Juan Guaido had his so-called re-election as head of the National Assembly, it was done in an opposition newspaper's offices. It was done in the offices of El Nacional, which is a super hard right anti-government newspaper, which is publishing. And I believe it's only online now, or it still may have some paper. It's a very small circulation. It most recently had, relative to population, about the same paper circulation as the Washington Post. So it's amazing. It's a significant newspaper in Venezuela. So, and it's extremely hard right, very anti-government, and similar way. It's even the broadcast media, if you follow them, but that's is more neutral. Like they have pro and anti-government voices on, but they have the major broadcasters are Venevisión, Globovisión, Televen. The private broadcasters, they regularly have people just blasting the government in the most aggressive way, even coming, supporting sanctions and everything right on their newscast. So, the media has a level of freedom which would be it would never be allowed in our own countries under these conditions. So, it's unbelievably hypocritical. But again, the propaganda is key, convincing people that this is okay. And that's where Trudeau comes in. That's their primary contribution, along with all the other allies. The majority of the world's governments do not recognize Juan Guaido as president or interim president of Venezuela. It's really absurd. First of all, he never even ran in any election to be president. Maduro was elected president in May of 2018, and there's no reasonable. I mean, it's a long story to debunk that. You have to get into a lot, but there's no reasonable grounds for saying he has less legitimacy than anybody else in the region, including Trump, who didn't even win the popular vote when he won his election. So, it's really ridiculous, but that's the power of propaganda. You can tell you up is down, black is white, and that's Canada's role.
Well, and our own media too. They're fond of repeating what you just said, that the 50 countries around the world support Guaido's claim on the presidency of Venezuela, while 150 don't. While Guaido was up here in Canada meeting with our Prime Minister Trudeau, who supports him wholeheartedly, he put out a press release just before saying, quote, "I commend interim President Guaido for the courage and leadership he has shown in his efforts to return democracy to Venezuela, and I offer Canada's continued support," et cetera, et cetera. Well, for their part, Canada's media, they were busy blasting anybody who would offer that kind of support for the Maduro government. Nikki Ashton of the NDP is an outspoken supporter, and she found disfavor with the newish media outlet in Canada, the Post Millennial, who blasted her for supporting the communist dictator Maduro. For Canadians who might be confused about just what's going on, as you just described, there's plenty of opposition within Venezuela. The media is mostly controlled by wealthy people. Joe, how is it they have wealthy people in a communist dictatorship?
Well, that's the thing. The word communist, that's interesting because, now there is a segment of the population that calling somebody a communist or saying he's a socialist or otherwise left wing, that's a red flag. That's a way to disparage them, and that's it's considered effective. But there's a certain segment of the population in Canada, United States, that isn't really comfortable with going. I wouldn't be very comfortable with going along with a campaign to oust a left wing government or even a communist government. It pushes the wrong buttons. So there are organizations that try to approach it from the other angle. For instance, if you follow Venezuela Analysis online, I encourage people to follow them and to read their articles and to follow them on Twitter. They recently had an exchange with this group, the so-called human rights group in Washington, D.C., the Washington Office for Latin America, WOLA. Where WOLA is actually, they're mocking Maduro because, Maduro has made some, and it's always been the case that multinationals have always dealt in Venezuela under Chavez. I mean, ever since he was first elected, it's not a communist country. They have a huge private sector. Multinationals are involved with exploiting Venezuelan oil and other resources, and it's always been the case. Now, what shifted under Chavez was the terms, the conditions under which they get to operate, right? And there was some expropriation, but there's obviously a huge private sector and in dealings with the with multinationals. I mean, it's inevitable in the most powerful countries in the world, also are home to the most powerful multinationals. So unless a country really imposes sanctions on itself and seals itself off from foreign trade at all, which would be utter disaster, then it's inevitable that it will deal in some way with foreign multinationals. It's impossible not to. I mean, Venezuela was still a huge supporter of huge exporter of oil to the United States, and mm-hmm. It was the fourth largest exporter of the foreign supplied oil to the United States. Venezuela was the fourth largest, so it was all, that was under Chavez. So, but what these people from WOLA and others, they like to do is they say, they support the attacks on Venezuela, but they want to do it from a slightly different angle. And they basically mock Maduro saying that he's actually not, that he's actually right wing or that he's neoliberal or, those terms. So the talking points change. And they'll also say, people like that will also tend to focus on saying, Guaido is now former political party, Voluntad Popular, is actually a part of the Socialist International. That's another talking point. So there's another set of talking points that are used kind of to market the attacks on Venezuela from a slightly different angle. So instead of calling him like a communist dictator, they'll say, actually, no, you know what? He's a capitalist dictator. Yeah. So it's like, does that end up with a certain segment of the population? That's a more appealing line. You know what I mean? So there's always people willing to market it with different rationalizations. But basically, the underlying assumption is the United States gets to overthrow a country's governments, that they're somehow, it's a legitimate thing to do, that to starve them economically, to threaten military invasion, to openly incite military rebellion. That's all okay. And it's the only thing that changes from, one group to another generally is just kind of the rationalizations that are offered.
Well, and Nikki Ashton, again, the NDP MP who has the audacity to support the elected, the duly elected Maduro government, in criticizing the pretender Juan Guaido, or Juan Guano, as I like to call him, she had the temerity to mention that Juan Guano wasn't even elected. That drew the ire of Canadian columnist Terry Glavin, a far-right writer, who says that, well, yes, Guaido was indeed elected and that Nikki Ashton is practicing propaganda by saying he wasn't. Can you straighten me out on this? Now, is Guaido, is he elected to anything? Is he legitimate?
Okay, he's elected, but not as president. He's elected as the as a representative to the National Assembly. Mm-hmm. So it would be like in Canada, just some foreign country appointing a random MP from the back benches of the say the Conservatives and say, you know what, we're going to recognize him as the Prime Minister of Canada. Okay, mm-hmm. Even though his party didn't win. Okay, it's slightly different because we don't have a presidential system. But foreign countries decide, okay, this backbench MP, because we support him, he's now the Prime Minister. We recognize him as the interim Prime Minister or something. Maybe a more exact analogy, it would be like in the United States deciding, because it's a presidential system, we would be like deciding some House of Representatives, the member of Congress, and saying he's the interim president now. He never actually ran for president. He was elected to his congressional district to represent them, but we're gonna recognize him as the president of the whole country. So that's basically what's going on. Juan Guaido was elected in 2015 to represent a particular district in the National Assembly. And so when Maduro's new term officially started in 2019, they invoked Article 233 of the Venezuelan Constitution and said when there's when the president is absent for a period of time, that the whoever's elected head of the National Assembly takes over as interim president. I mean, that doesn't really, even some opposition writers, just weeks before this was done, even some opposition writers were saying that, they were debating whether they should do this, and they say, well, that doesn't really make sense because Maduro's not absent. We can claim he wasn't properly elected, the election wasn't fair or whatever, but we can't really, the Constitution doesn't really, that article doesn't even apply in this case because he's not absent. He hasn't gone missing, he hasn't been hospitalized or, something like that. So, The opposition parties had an agreement to rotate the presidency of the National Assembly among themselves. So when Juan Guaido's party, eventually at that same time that he was elected by the National Assembly to be their to be the president of the National Assembly by the other assemblymen and women. So that's how that happened. So it was basically based on a very just a ridiculous interpretation of the Constitution. For a few, one, it doesn't really apply because Maduro wasn't absent. More importantly, though, the election was fair. I mean, that wasn't a fair election. He won because there was a huge segment of the opposition, including Juan Guaido's party at the time, who basically preferred to discredit the election by abstaining rather than running, and they aren't unified. They're even worse now, and so that's why they lost. And Maduro retains about a support of roughly 30% of the population. He's shown that consistently, despite the economic conditions, because of the tactics of the opposition, which is to support foreign attacks on your own country. I mean, it's not hard to figure out that, you know, if we're going through a major depression and you have political parties that are openly trying to make it worse, that a certain segment of the population could be totally turned off by that, you know. And like I said, I just, in our own countries, that wouldn't even be tolerated. So that's basically, it's basically just ridiculous interpretations of the Constitution that have, basically the United States and all the people willing to go along with it have said, okay, that's why he's the interim president. But it really has no validity.
Well, and the Canadian government position with our new foreign minister, Champagne, he made a statement on the occasion of Guano's visit here. He said that, he wanted to see free and fair elections held in Venezuela, right, as if the election that brought Maduro back to power was not right, free and fair. But he also said he wanted to see it international monitors in attendance, when in fact, the Venezuelan election had quite a few people from outside the country watching it, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It's a very tight system in terms of even a very small amount of fraud can be detected. It's a very automated system that they have for elections, in addition to other audits and they have before and after the election. So, you know, the bottom line is Maduro won the election by four million votes. There's no, you know, his closest competitor barely got two. You know, Henry Falcone, who was defied U.S. sanctions to go to run in the election. Now, by the way, he's totally behind Guaido, this Falcone character. It wasn't even close. So that they tried to do in the media, say, well, because of the turnout was so low that we can dismiss the election. Major problem with that is the actual percentage of the electorate that Maduro won is very comparable. It's actually higher than what typically wins elections in Canada, the United States, the UK. You know, so they really don't have a leg to stand on. The other point now is that there's been a military coup in Bolivia.
Right.
So you actually do have a real dictatorship, not the made up one in Venezuela, but the actual real one. And the reason it came about was because of a really sleazy audit that was done by the so-called International Observers. The OAS did an electoral monitoring there, which was just scandalous, dishonest and misleading. And it provided the fodder for the military and these right-wing vigilante groups to basically drive the duly elected president out of office. It was absolutely outrageous. And so these are the people who are also at the same time the OAS and their bureaucracy, which is based in Washington and primarily funded by Washington. They're the ones who are pontificating about democracy in Venezuela when they just got finished helping to destroy democracy in Bolivia.
Yeah,
that's absolutely outrageous.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Joe Emmersberger. Joe's a Canada-based writer. His work is featured at fair.org, Venezuela Analysis, The Canary. He's an engineer, a Unifor member, proud Canadian. He's also seen at Telesur and ZNet. Well, Joe, Bolivia now, it's kind of the dark mirror image of Venezuela, the what-if scenario. We don't have to wonder what if Maduro had have been overthrown as was planned by outside forces. We can see exactly what would happen in Bolivia. Just up the road there, Janine Añez, she's described as the caretaker president. She is running against against her prior promises not to go beyond being a caretaker, governor, in the May 3 elections that are set for Bolivia. Now, what about these elections? Of course, I should mention that Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, until he was overthrown in this coup that isn't recognized as such in this country and others too, his popularity was towering. I mean, any politician in this country or America or any other Western democracy would kill to have the kind of numbers that Evo Morales had. And yet they're okay with that. But why did – now, Morales won't be allowed to run. He's in Argentina in exile. But he is okayed that somebody else run for president. What's the issue here now? What's going on with Bolivia in this election coming May 3rd?
Well, what we have is first of all, Añez was never right from the get-go. From the day she took power, she was a dictator. She was installed by the military. If you look at the pictures of her swearing in, it's just military people putting the sash on her. The military basically drove Morales out with the help of right-wing paramilitaries. The OAS started it off with really bogus claims of electoral fraud. I wrote a lengthy piece on fair.org about it. I'm relying heavily on the work of the statistical experts at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. They did a very extensive takedown of the OAS monitoring. It's absolutely scandalous what they claimed. Morales got 47% of the vote on 88% turnout, which is, basically that working out the eligible voters, that starts to approach double what typically wins elections in, like, say, Canada, the United States. That was in line, what the support he got was in line with what pre-election polls predicted. There's no basis for the claim that the OAS monitoring is sketchy and extreme. Like I said, CEPR, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, did extensive work showing that the audit was not credible. And, it's been buried by the media. I mean, Reuters, in the article I wrote, I pointed out, they wrote, by my count, they're up to like 120 articles about the political situation in Bolivia since the October 20 election, without any mention whatsoever of the CEPR's extensive criticism of the OAS monitoring. So, I mean, that's just inexcusable. There's just deliberately choosing to suppress a huge part of the story. And it's in order to create this, again, this aura of certainty about something that we have no right to be certain about at all, in fact, that we should actually dismiss. So that's what's going on there. They basically did it a fraudulent audit. That created the spark, the excuse for the right-wing rioters, for the private media over there, for the generals, to turn on Morales and basically drive him out of the country. There's immediately an arrest warrant issued for him. The dictatorship was stupid enough to actually ask Interpol to arrest him, which resulted in Interpol throwing out the request for an arrest warrant for him. But Morales, if he goes back to Bolivia, he had escaped for his life. His house was ransacked right after he was. The day after. And he was left basically to save his own skin. And his resignation came at the point of a gun. Now, since then, he's, made, I guess you would call a pragmatic decision to basically say, well, we're just going to have to move forward now and try to participate in elections, even though they're being overseen by a dictatorship that's been imprisoning his supporters, his top-level supporters, just one after another being arrested, media outlets being censored, journalists being arrested, driven into hiding. I mean, the conditions for the elections, these are not free and fair elections. I mean, a U.S.-backed dictatorship is not there to run free and fair elections. Yeah. What they're there to do is try to tilt the playing field in favor of the people they want to win, the U.S.-backed right wing in Bolivia. But there's problems there because they're divided. They've killed a lot of people also. They killed at least 30 people to basically consolidate this uh, this coup to pacify, to keep the protests at bay after the coup took place. So it's really a horrendous situation. And, of course, the usual hypocrites like Canada and the United States, they're all, 100% behind it. They'll issue the human rights groups have been useless. I mean, actually been supportive of this, issuing these really timid, just to cover their asses, basically, just to say, oh, please, asking the Áñez dictatorship to, to not get carried away. And that's basically it. I mean, they are just without any credibility whatsoever. And we see that it's a real, like you say, it's a really strong message about what kind of stuff they would tolerate in Venezuela. Because right. You have to remember, Morales wasn't subject to 2 decades worth of demonization the way Venezuela's government has been. I mean, Morales is not as important regionally as Venezuela. And also just because at the time, for so long when they were going after Venezuela, there were so many left-wing governments in the region, it didn't make sense to go after everybody at once. The focus has also always been on Venezuela, who the United States regarded as most dangerous to their hegemony in the region. They really feared that. And you see this from the WikiLeaks documents. They really feared more than anything that he could exert regional influence, be an alternative source of financing, and just basically counter the ability of the United States to get its way in the region through economic bullying, because you have a source of oil wealth there that can finance alternatives.
1, 2, 3, 4. This is Chris Chandler and Paul Benoit in the great city of Victoria. When I'm here, I listen to All Good News all the time. That's CFUV, my favorite radio station, because it's independent and alternative media. I consider them the big media. They give you the real story. And when I'm not here, I listen to it online at cfuv.ca.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Joe Emmisberger. Well, I imagine that Morales' huge popularity had something to do with their deciding not to pick on him, even as much as some of the things he said about America and the empire and so forth, and his support for Hugo Chavez was an irritant.
Sure, but that's more recently because Maduro definitely lost popularity for Chavismo. Definitely taking it. I mean, still has 30% support, but back when Chavez was around, in the better days, I mean, he was, he won, for example, in 2006. Chavez won re-election with over 60% of the vote on a very high turnout. So he was up around, he was very easily comparable to Morales, who was achieving several years ago. So he was popular. They went after him anyway because Venezuela, with its huge oil reserves, is even more of and just a wealthier country than Bolivia. Bolivia has always been the poorest country in South America. So,
well, does Bolivia, Joe, have the same kind of media concentration of the elite as you see in Venezuela? Yeah.
Oh, definitely. You can see that. I've looked at their media and written up some things about how you report. It's actually pretty ridiculous. Right-wing media has been a key part of the success of the coup. It's the whole point is to make sure that now when you have this Áñez dictatorship, they can make sure the public media just echoes. I mean, they immediately censored Telesur, for example. They drove Telesur off the air. So they immediately, what they're doing is basically just imposing a media hegemony. And then on top of their murdering protesters, and on top of that, arresting and threatening high-level members of Morales' party. Mm-hmm. So all that combined, they're trying to set the stage for elections that the right has a better chance of doing well in or even winning. But their problems is because they're so divided among themselves. And that's one of the reasons you mentioned Áñez deciding to run is they're a mess. They're all bickering and turning on each other. So they're for their own reasons. It kind of mirrors what's going on in Venezuela. That they're their own. They undermine themselves, and without these foreign powers, smashing their heads together. Hey guys, get them, telling them to get their shit together. Basically, they wouldn't stand a chance. They would very seldom win an election. At least not that extremist faction that the U.S. tends to support would basically be electorally irrelevant. You probably. Without U.S. interference, you'd still have a right-wing opposition, but it'd probably be more like a normal opposition, that's trying to win elections, not trying to overthrow the government by a military coup with foreign support.
Well, as far as Evo's former colleagues being attacked, indeed, just a couple few hours ago, Camila over at Telesur tweeted mm-hmm. out that Evo Morales's former minister Cesar Navarro had been violently arrested. He's out now, but he'd been arrested, roughed up, and there's pictures of him showing his, you know, he was injured, you know, bleeding, and so they still are targeting Joe. In the first few days and week or so after the coup, there was talk that, like Lavalas, the party of Jean Aristide in Haiti, was not allowed to run in the next elections, that the mass party of Evo Morales wouldn't be allowed to run. Well, that seems to have, was that just rumor, or was there an actual policy reversal on that?
It's funny you mention that, because Human Rights Watch, their Americas director, tweeted out a congratulations to the electoral authorities of Bolivia for allowing mass to, not outlawing mass. And yeah, you're right, Lavalas in Haiti after that coup was in 2004, which Canada was very firmly supportive mm-hmm. of. Yeah, Lavalas has been basically not only subjected to terror campaign and arrest and intimidation, but it was also just made illegal. It was just not allowed to run, period. Just so for many years. So in the case of Masto, they're trying to tone it down a little bit, you know. It's so you have these idiotic statements like from Human Rights Watch congratulating people for not outlawing a party, you know. It's just outrageous. I mean, can you imagine like sending a note to Canada, say, hey, congratulations for not outlawing the Conservatives in this election? You know, I mean, as if that were some kind of you need a pat on the
head. It's a pretty low bar. Will they allow foreign observers in to watch the election in Bolivia?
I don't see why they wouldn't allow the OAS. I mean,
the OAS, yeah, but I mean, I mean, actual ones like Jimmy Carter's organization or others.
Yeah, I wouldn't even trust Jimmy Carter's, to be honest with you. But the whole establishment, right through and through, is very. It's just very, very different flavors of bought off and complicit. It's. I don't know how much they'll get away with. They can't get away with every. They can't get away with everything, or else, like you said, they would have followed the example of Pedro Carmona. You know, after he seized power, the New York Times, everyone else was mm-hmm. happy to recognize him, but they would took the step of actually dismissing the Supreme Court, dismissing all the National Assembly, all the. So they went a step beyond, and made it, I guess, a little uncomfortable for the foreign supporters to back them. They had to wag a finger at them, say, hey, that wasn't good, because he was already a dictator just by virtue of the fact that the Chavez was kidnapped
Joe,
then they went a step beyond and made it more obvious.
Joe, you gotta flesh this out a little bit. Now, Carmona, you gotta flesh out a little bit, because this is my favorite political story of all time, the coup against Hugo Chavez in 2002, and Carmona came in with his gang behind him. He was as I remember, he was just a figurehead of these guys, one of the rich elite that they put up front, much as like in Mad Max, they put somebody on the, they put a guy on the front of the car. And then what happened?
Well, okay, now Pedro Carmona was the head of the largest business federation in Venezuela, Fedecameras. What happened was there was a coup in April of 2002. There were mass protests by the opposition against Chavez, because he was already beginning to do things that were infringing on the basically pissing off the usual power brokers, the ones who had always run Venezuela, and he was pissing them off. And he had won a series of elections already by that time, not just his original election in 98, but he had prevailed in a few referendums and the National Assembly super elections that were held. So he had prevailed a bunch of times. He had basically whooped them in a bunch of elections, and they were getting sick of getting electorally beaten up. So they decided to, they turned on him because he was for a lot of reasons. And so what happened was there was huge protests. There was some shooting, between pro and anti government supporters at these protests. There were, and basically some about 19 people died, basically split between pro and anti-government supporters because they marched on the presidential palace. And then, of course, the private media in Venezuela said, oh, here you go, Chavez fired and killed all these protesters. And it was actually, over years later, came out. The most likely thing was there were looked to be snipers in right. nearby buildings who were basically firing on people, basically to create a spark that would lead to some kind of confrontation, and that would be the excuse for the military and other people to step in and throw Chavez out. So that's what happened, and with the total support of the private media, and then this guy comes forward who declares himself I'm the interim president, Pedro Carmona, head of the largest business federation, and now he immediately has support of the United States and various other, in the New York Times and the media, there may be a few cases, maybe a little uncomfortable, but they were happy with him throwing out Chavez. But then Carmona, what he did was he immediately annulled the Constitution. He immediately changed the name of the Venezuela. He immediately fired all the Supreme Court. He did this all through the so-called Carmona Decree, which was signed by prominent opposition members. And, they did this on video, too, and, where they read out this decree. So, like I said, fires the Supreme Court, fires the International National Assembly, changes the name. It just goes on, just basically goes overboard. And it makes it hard even for his foreign support. And it also it makes it hard for his foreign supporters to deny that the guy is a dictator. But also, it made it very internally there was it rankled some people who were left out. Because he was giving away ministries to his faction of the opposition and basically snubbing some of the other factions. And it created internal divisions. And eventually, because Chavez came from the military, he had firm knowledge of the military. So unlike Morales, Chavez maybe had a better understanding of military, how it works, and how to maintain loyalty. And a loyalist faction of the military also turned on the coup and launched a counterattack. And there was also mass demonstrations. People rallied in the streets, in support of Chavez. So the coup was reversed, and it was, as people say, the first time in history a U.S.-backed coup in Latin America got turned around. It was a huge defeat. It totally discredited the opposition because, so many people who are still leading lights in the opposition were fully behind the coup, like Leopoldo López, Maria Corina Machado, all these names that if you follow Western media coverage, even today, you'll see they're always coming up. They're always being cited uncritically by these reporters. And they're all supportive of the coup. Enrique Capriles, Henry Ramos, all these people. So, so the coup was reversed. And from there, eventually Chavez was able to, in response to that, over the next few years, he's able to purge the military of its most, of the people most likely to try this again. So, and that's of course, one of the reasons that Maduro hasn't been overthrown, whereas Morales has. I mean, Maduro does not have the popular support that Morales had. And still probably has in Bolivia, yet Maduro's still there, and Morales has been overthrown, been driven out of the country, can't even return. So that just shows you something about the importance of having control of the military.
Well, and now it seems that it's given them a lesson that when they took Chavez in 2002, they took him prisoner and flew him out of the country, much as they did with Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti. They didn't kill him. The last time there was an attempt, they tried to blow up Maduro with one of these drones in a kind of attack that we may be seeing more of in the future. Mm-hmm. Well, Joe, I mean, it's not just in South America. You were writing, too, especially on Twitter recently, about what happened in the recent election in the UK, and especially as it concerns Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party leader, who is left of centre by, I guess, all definitions of Western mm-hmm. politics. There's something called the Corbyn effect that I've read recently of, and this is where you, for fear of running afoul of Israel lobbyists, people bend and give and acquiesce to charges of anti-Semitism. You're talking recently, Joe, about what's going on in the run-up to the American election, where Bernie Sanders now is starting to feel that Corbyn effect. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's I think it's more generally about the importance of foreign policy. You know, people focus on Israel, and it's true. I mean, Israel is a it's a key U.S. ally. It's basically, I see it as basically a U.S. military outpost in an extremely strategically important part of the world. So, you know, of course, you have this tremendous one-sidedness in the way Israel is treated. But, you know, you have the same thing with any ally throughout the world in the United States. So, you know, the way the Venezuelan opposition is treated, any opposition that's backed by the United States, whether it's in Venezuela, Nicaragua, Bolivia, anything, they always get the special treatment. People who don't go along with it always get vilified. You know, Sanders has already, he's capitulated, calling several times, you know, he's backed down. And he totally goes along with this whole idea that Maduro's a vicious tyrant. He's called him, he called him a dictator. Indirectly, they asked if the New York Times editorial board pressured him basically to concede that Maduro was a dictator. I mean, just ridiculous. And before that, his campaign put out a letter calling even Chavez a dead communist dictator. So it's on foreign policy, I think. Now, of course, Israel, because it's so important, it's in such an important part of the world. It's a much more strong ally and reliable ally than, say, Colombia. I mean, Colombia is the United States' most subservient and probably useful ally in Latin America. But internally, they're faced with their own problems. They don't have the cohesiveness and the resources to be like Israel is in the United States. You know, Israel is the real attack dog of the United States. You know, they could seriously threaten other countries militarily, whereas, you know, Colombia just can't do that. I mean, they can, but they're not even close to the same amount. So there are differences there, but so it's on foreign policy that that there's tremendous pressure on any kind of progressive candidate just to give it to just focus on domestic policy and just let the usual establishment figures run the foreign policy.
Well, I saw it in the sense of Corbyn being charged with being an anti-Semite and mm-hmm. Sanders, Jewish himself, now also, right. You know, the threat that he's going to be labeled in the press as anti-Semitic is, right. Or self-hating. I don't know how they were going to, you know, how mm-hmm. they plan to frame this.
Yeah, sure, it depends. Well, it depends how much he capitulates to it. I mean, they will call him anti-Semitic and self-hating if he's cowardly enough to keep capitulating. The more practical tactic at first is just say that he tolerates anti-Semitism among his allies. That's what they used on Corbyn for the most mm-hmm. part, and then it ramped up as he kept giving ground and showing that he didn't have the spine to fight back. Then, of course, they amplified it to an even more audacious levels constantly, and to the point where he's being labeled a racist. Mm-hmm. But it all has to do with this mentality among politicians, especially if they get any kind of prominence, is to just give ground, especially on foreign policy, and but in the case of Corbyn, it went beyond that because, you know, it's one thing to give ground on Israel, but to give ground on letting yourself and your supporters be called anti-Semitic, that's just cowering before the corporate media in general. I mean, it got to the point where even John McDonnell, Corbyn's right-hand man, is going before letting himself be interviewed by Alistair Campbell, Tony Blair's former spinmeister, and saying that, you know, and basically kissing his ass, basically mm-hmm. saying, well, you know, Tony Blair wasn't so bad. He's not, no, of course, he's not a war criminal. And, oh, I hope he doesn't get remembered over here.
He had his faults.
And he gets to that point. It's a slippery slope. You know, it's a slippery slope where they keep capitulating until they basically, the message that's sent to their supporters is that, wow, these guys, they're never going to stand up for us. They can't even stand up for themselves. They'll let themselves get slapped around all day in public. So, you know, if somebody doesn't have the guts to stand up for themselves, why should you trust them to stand up for you? You know, and that's the danger, of course, for any progressive candidate. They'll be pressured to basically demean themselves publicly and discredit themselves. You know, and they fall into that trap again because it seems like the mentality of people who achieve prominence is so often a mentality that comes with your so-called pragmatism, but just mm-hmm. devolves into cowardice. Right? Yeah. There's no other word for it.
Well, going along to get along. Well, the man is Joe Amesburger. You can find Joe's writing again at fair.org, Venezuela Analysis, The Canary Counterpunch, and at my site too, also at Telesur. Joe, it's always fascinating to speak with you, and I really appreciate you coming on and for this extended version and on a weekend to boot.
Okay, thanks for having me on. It's been fun.
All right, then until the next time, Joe.